Лидер Национального фронта Марин Ле Пен.
Марин Ле Пен возглавляет Национальный
фронт. Лидер евроскептиков и один из идеологов.
Точно, Англии Найджел Фарадж.
Лидер этой фракции Герт Вилдерс.
Известного националиста Вилдерса.
Норберта Хофера.
Хофер не скрывает своих пророссийских взглядов.
Some are authoritarians and some are populists. Some are euroskeptics and some are xenophobes. And some are just opportunists. Many are anti-immigrant and most are anti-globalization. They feed on the fears and resentments of the disaffected, the humiliated, and the disenfranchised. They sow division, discord, chaos, and intolerance. And whether they're doing so willingly or unwittingly, they are nevertheless acting as the pawns in Vladimir Putin's great game. They're advancing the Kremlin leader's goal of tearing down Western liberal democracy. They're the foot soldiers of the Putin International, and they're on the march. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Washington, D.C. is Alina Polyakova, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and author of the book The Dark Side of European Integration. Welcome back, Alina. It's great to have you back on.
Great to be back, Brian.
And also joining us via Skype from Vienna is Anton Shekhovtsov, a visiting fellow at the Institute for Human Sciences and author of the forthcoming book, Russia and the Western Far Right, which should be out next spring. Welcome, Anton.
Hello, Brian. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thanks for being on. The Kremlin's been appealing to the far right in the West for years, but until recently, this looked a lot like trolling, like an attempt just to be disruptive. But it's becoming increasingly clear that Russia's support for and encouragement of anti-establishment forces isn't just trolling. It has very concrete goals, the weakening or dissolution of NATO and the European Union, and a shattering of transatlantic unity. An important report issued this week by the Atlantic Council, the Kremlin's Trojan Horses, illustrates Moscow's strategy in three European countries, France, Germany, and the UK. Alina, you were among the authors of this excellent and very important report. It looks very much like the groundwork the Kremlin has laid is establishing these networks of influence is finally paying off. Can you summarize what you found in the report briefly for us?
Well, thanks, Brian, first of all, for reading the report. This report really tried to look at Russian influence and Russian networks of political influence, specifically in what we can call Europe's core countries. So we often talk about Russian influence being very effective in the post-socialist space, essentially Eastern Europe. You know, we just had elections in Bulgaria and Moldova that turned up with pro-Russian governments that are going to be the head of those countries. We might have a similar situation in Estonia. So it's easy to just dismiss those and say, well, look, this is the post-socialist space. What do you expect? Estonia has lots of Russians. Bulgaria has always been pro-Russian. Moldova, you know, they've been communists for much of the time after the Cold War. But the point here is that Western Europe is not exempt and is certainly not immune from similar opaque networks that seek to destabilize polities, destabilize decision-making, and make it much more difficult for the centrist government, center-left or center-right, to govern effectively within the EU framework. And honestly, none of this information is new. It's that we have not been paying attention to it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's due to a certain hubris of the West to say, well, look, we have these strong democracies. We're not vulnerable to foreign influence from authoritarian regimes like Russia. But what this report shows is that, no, we are absolutely vulnerable to Russian interference in our politics. And, of course, in the U.S., we have been experiencing this with our own presidential campaigns.
Yeah, no, that's the big elephant in the room right now. I want to stick with you for a minute, Alina, and zero in on something you said. You talk about these opaque networks, and I want to kind of pull a quote out of the report here, where you write, "The web of political networks is hidden and non-transparent by design, making it purposely difficult to expose. Traceable financial links would inevitably make Moscow's enterprise less effective. When ostensibly independent political figures call for closer relations with Russia, the removal of sanctions or criticize the EU and NATO, it legitimizes the Kremlin's worldview. It is far less effective from the Kremlin's point of view to have such statements come from individuals or organizations known to be on the Kremlin payroll." The reason I pulled that quote out is because when we think of this, we tend to focus on the figures at the top, your Marine Le Pens or your Nigel Farages and so on. But really below this, there is a broad network that's supporting it, is it not?
No, that's exactly right. And the point there, I'm glad you pulled it out, Brian, because it's incredibly important. You know, we often want to understand influence as a kind of a direct relationship, you know, a quid pro quo relationship. The Kremlin gives Party X, Marine Le Pen, anybody, you know, some money, and then they espouse a pro-Kremlin, pro-Russian agenda. But that's just simply not how it actually works. Because, of course, if you have a think tank that says it's independent, or you have a civil society, NGO organization that says it's independent, you have a political party or an MP who's part of a major political party. I mean, this is also something we need to think about, is that the interesting thing that's happening in Western Europe specifically is that these relationships are no longer just tied to the fringes, to the far right or to the far left. We're seeing more and more influence seeping into the center, both on the center left and on the center right. And I think that is incredibly problematic, and we need to look at it more. But again, just to go back to this question of why being opaque is so beneficial to the Kremlin. Well, look, obviously, you know, if we knew Nigel Farage was basically a foreign agent of the Kremlin, and he would be seen as a lobbyist, right?
Right.
Or if some other organization was basically a lobbyist for a foreign government, and then we take what they say with a grain of salt. But if they say, no, we're independent, we just think this is the right worldview, that is much more effective in convincing people.
Yeah. No, and another thing that jumped out at me, we're going to get into the individual countries in the second half of the program, but the one of the things that really jumped out at me is, just you said, Alina, it's not just the fringes. If you look in France, everybody talks about Le Pen, but everybody ignores that the influence among the Republican Party in France is also very strong, and the influence among the socialists in France is also very strong. And you could say the same thing in Germany with the SDP as opposed for AfD. So it's this is something I want to get into a little bit more in the second half. I wanted to now turn to Anton. You've been researching ties between Russia and the far right in the West longer than most of us, and you probably know more about it than certainly I'll ever forget. And we're all certainly looking forward to your forthcoming book. We've had Brexit. We've had the U.S. elections. We had pro-Moscow candidates winning in Bulgaria and Moldova. We have elections that we'll discuss in the second half coming up in Germany, the Netherlands, and France. Are we at a critical juncture now, Anton? Is this Putin's moment?
Well, I do think that this is a moment where we should be very much focused on the very legitimate threats that are coming from various pro-Russian initiatives originating from different Western countries. I want to underline, though, one idea that I think is true, that if we look at the 90s, if we look at how Russia behaved already in the 90s, and we will see that essentially the West was still cooperating with the Russian Federation under Yeltsin during the first term of President Putin. And we can see that Russia violated human rights nationally, domestically and internationally. But the West and some leaders, Western leaders, they just ignored all those developments. So this is nothing new. What we have now, all those pro-Russian initiatives, all those calls for lifting the sanctions, etc., etc. I want to bring names like Gerhard Schröder or Nicolas Sarkozy or Silvio Berlusconi, those longtime friends of Mr. Putin, who are much more influential than Marine Le Pen or Nigel Farage. So again, this is not something new, but what we are having now is when various initiatives, they come together, and now they pose a very, very direct threat to Western liberal democracy.
And do you think that, are we at a critical juncture right now? Anne Applebaum famously said not long ago, we're just a couple of elections away from the end of the West as we know it. Is she right?
I completely agree with Anne on this. And I think that 2017 will be a crucial year. We have elections in the Netherlands, we have elections in France and in Germany. In December, still this year, we have presidential elections, rerun of the second round of the presidential elections in Austria, mm-hmm. where the far-right candidate Norbert Hofer has huge chances to win the presidential post. It's still not the main post in the country. Still, the chancellor has much more power, but still, symbolically, it would be quite disastrous. And with the election of Trump, I think we now should understand that the anti-establishment sentiments are no longer just, you know, a headache for the mainstream politicians and Western liberal Democrats, but they can get into power. So the consensus that worked since the end of the Second World War, that populists and, you know, anti-establishment figures, far-rightists, racists, and xenophobes cannot win elections, this consensus is broken. Mm-hmm. We are now in the open waters. We don't know what is going to happen next year or even now.
And I would add another important thing coming up this month. The French Republican Party will have its primary, and choose the candidate that's going to run against Le Pen in the second round, right?
Yeah, it's my personal hope that Alain Juppé will win the primaries in the Republican Party.
I suspect you're not alone in that hope. But although I would not rule out Sarkozy winning or Fillon winning, and either of those would be much more friendly toward Russia. Another thing I want to kind of turn to on this is how much is Putin contributing to this anti-establishment feeling in the West, and how much is he just piggybacking? Because if you look at different things that are going on here, I mean, you have the influence networks, the direct support for the far right, and then you have things like the disinformation campaign, which was illustrated by the Lisa case so starkly in Germany. How much, let's start with you, Alina, how much do you think Putin's contributing to this and actually create, I mean, he didn't create it, but he's certainly egging it on, and how much is he just piggybacking on an existing thing?
Right. I think that's the million-dollar question. I think most people agree, and, you know, as Anton and I have been following the rise of the populist far right for many years, these are domestically driven phenomena. You know, we didn't elect Donald Trump in the United States because Putin, methodologically tampered in our election systems. Le Pen is not soaring in the polls in France because of her likes for Putin either. And this is the case across all of Central Eastern Europe and Western Europe as well. So these are domestically driven phenomenon. People are obviously discontent. We saw an increase in parliamentary elections in terms of how much vote and support the far right started to receive, particularly after the financial crisis, mm-hmm. which I think really hit people's trust in Western institutions, Western economic models. So we've seen this economic stagnation really, I think, contribute to a sense of anxiety about the future and other things as well, like the refugee crisis, right? And Brexit is also another kind of phenomenon, manifestation of this kind of growing turn towards nationalism, towards isolationism, and in a way for what you can call a globalism or internationalism. On the other hand, despite these being domestically driven phenomena, what Russia has been very good at under Putin is stirring the pot. So balancing things out and giving them a little bit more of a boost, potentially either with money when we have evidence of that, such as the case with the National Front, potentially with Jobbik as well, and by building these relationships that really undermine the entire vision of the European project, a Western liberal democracy, you know, this idea of the system being corrupt. There's no such thing as free and fair elections. And this kind of narrative is very much aligned with what you hear from the far right. And it's hard to say, you know, to what extent the Kremlin has been systematically and analytically doing this, and to what extent this was a natural alignment that also serves both actors' interests, serves the Kremlin's interests, and also serves the far-right political interests in their own domestic politics.
You know, I think the corruption is also something we need to look at in kind of coordination with the disinformation and the support for the far right. It's ironic that people in the West see the system as corrupt and are turning to parties that are in partnership with the main exporter of corruption in the world, which is what we basically have. I mean, I've said many times, corruption is like the new communism. The black cash is the new red menace. So the Kremlin's black cash is the new red menace. Antoine, what are your thoughts on this? How much is Putin contributing to this? How much is he piggybacking? Or is it, as Alina suggested, a little of both?
Well, if we look at the actual contact between various Russian actors and the far right in the West, we will see that many groups are involved. Some of the groups, from the Russian side, I mean, some of the groups are connected to the Kremlin directly. Some of the groups and the majority of groups and individuals and movements, they are not connected to the Kremlin. They are trying to build those contacts with the Western far right, with the pro-Russian, various pro-Russian actors in the West, in order to sell those contacts to the Kremlin in a competition for the resources that the Kremlin manages.
Mm.
For example, I looked at the history of the relations between the Russians and Western far right activists. So part of the history is from the beginning of the 90s. And until, I would say, 2005, 2006, the Kremlin was not interested at all in those contacts because they still had good relations with mainstream politicians. And there were many initiatives. Vladimir Zhirinovsky, the leader of the far-right party in Russia,
the LDP,
Alexander Dugin, Russian fascist, essentially, Sergei Glazyev, who is now advisor to Putin. Those were quite marginal figures, probably except Zhirinovsky, who was leader of a very strong party. They all built contacts from the 90s, and they tried to use those contacts to raise their own position and status within the far right in Russia. But they and they gradually wanted to sell those contacts, you know, to not to come to power, but to get some of the resources that Putin's system controls.
Mm-hmm.
And from 2005, 2006, we see how various initiatives were gaining more and more attention from the people connected to the Kremlin, to the decision-making. First of all, that was electoral observation or fake electoral observation,
mm-hmm.
to give legitimacy to various electoral processes that would be considered illegitimate or unfair by the international institutions, such as, say, referenda in South Ossetia, in Transnistria, in Abkhazia, in Nagorno-Karabakh. And then the media, the Russian state-controlled media, decided to engage with Western far-right politicians because I think they started to understand that there were less and less mainstream politicians who would be saying something pro-Russian or pro-Putin. So they turned to the far-right activists who were from the 90s, were already happy to praise Russia, post-Soviet Russia, for many reasons. But they were already, you know, prepared to do this. But the Kremlin was not interested at first, and then it became increasingly interested. And now we see that it is interested more and more in those contacts.
It's interesting you say the year 2005, and I'm like, why would this have begun to take off in the year 2005? Was this a reaction after the Orange Revolution when the Kremlin kind of reoriented in a increasingly more anti-Western direction? Would that be the trigger?
The series of color revolutions, first in Georgia, mm-hmm. then in Ukraine, and then in Kyrgyzstan.
Mm-hmm.
And the Kremlin became really, really afraid that something like that could happen in Russia. I think it was exaggerated, those the threats of a color revolution in Russia. But the elites, they became really, really scared.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought it was that the West somehow violated a contract with Russia, a contract that the Russians thought was consisted in a very simple argument. You do whatever you want. We keep good economic relations. We benefit each other. But mm-hmm. when the Kremlin thought that, okay, so Ukraine was essentially, or Georgia were essentially in the Russian sphere of influence. And then those color revolutions, they were blamed on the State Department, on Soros, and you know, the usual suspects. So the Russians thought, okay, this is a violation of some contract that they thought they had with the West. And this is the moment where the system in Russia, the regime, became increasingly anti-Western, especially anti-American.
Yeah, and it's...
So that was a crucial turning point.
And it's that turning point is interesting because if a lot of ways, if you to try to seek to understand what Russia's doing with the West now, many people have put it this way, they're doing what they think the West is doing to them, even though the West isn't doing this to them.
Right.
They're doing what the West, they think the West is doing to them. So we try to interfere in their internal politics, so therefore they're going to interfere in our internal politics. And this was just around, starting, I guess, in 2005 and after, they began to feel strong enough to be able to do that. Another thing I wanted to zero in on is these anti-establishment figures themselves in the West. To what degree are they actively colluding with Putin out of conviction, or are they just opportunists? Is there a meeting of the minds here? Is there a Putin nationalist international, which is something of a contradiction in terms, which is why I like it for headline. What's the degree of collusion? How much conviction is involved here? How much opportunism is involved? Did you get a sense of that, Alina?
You know, I've done, not in this particular report that we're talking about today, but in the past I've done some work trying to understand the ideological alignments, trying to figure out, is this really just a quid pro quo kind of relationship, or is there something, you know, more coherent there that is really about the coming together of ideas? I think there is to some extent, but there's a caveat to that, which I'll explain in a moment. You know, for the most part, you could say that Western far-right parties share a few things in common. They're anti-EU, they're anti-immigrant, they're anti-globalism, globalization, trade. And then some are also very pro-traditional family values, not all, but the majority are. Law and order, rules-based system, kind of strong leadership. But they're not anti-democratic, which is very important. So if you look at these ideas that come that really coalesce in this, you could call it like Western far-right political movement, these are some of the ideas that the Kremlin state-sponsored media often puts out there, you know, about cultural decline of the West, as we can see from the expansion of rights to the LGBTQ community, for example. I mean, this was something that was very popular in the Russian state propaganda, right? That the West is in this cultural decline, degradation, because look, they have some of the Conchita Wurst who wins the Eurovision contest one year, who's a cross-dresser, right? And then you have, you know, men marrying men and women marrying women. Like, what is this all leading to, right? So we have to go back to our traditional family values, which, of course, Russia never had.
Right.
Certainly not under the Soviet period. So there is a little of this ideological alignment, you know, rules-based order, you know, about national sovereignty. But, you know, I actually think that for the far right in Europe, these are genuine convictions for the most part. I mean, of course, you're going to have opportunists. You're going to have opportunists anywhere. And you're going to have true believers. And you're going to have free riders in any sort of political movement or political party. My conviction is that the Kremlin under Putin is essentially non-ideological, that there is no set of ideas that's really driving the Kremlin forward, driving Putin forward. I think the main goal of the regime is just to stay in power for as long as possible. And that's not really an ideology, right? Mm-hmm. And then they will use ideologies and ideas when they see it's convenient to build alliances and to build these kinds of relationships that we've been talking about. And I also want to go back to another thing. I mean, Anton was describing this shift in 2005 or so. But we have to remember, in some ways, this kind of strategy is nothing new. If you look at Russia, was coming out of the Soviet Union, of course, and being sort of the natural carrier of the Soviet system. We had active measures, that's a Soviet term, during the Cold War, agents of influence, useful idiots. These are all things that we thought we could just forget about, but they were very common during the Cold War years. Russia funded left-wing communist groups that tried to destabilize politics in Europe all the time and elsewhere as well, not just Europe. So in many ways, I also see Putin kind of resurrecting some of these old tactics and strategies from the Soviet period and applying them in new ways.
I mean, I would also add that on the ideological thing, I think there is, it's not an ideology, but there's a larger goal beyond staying in power, and that is to basically get to expand Russia's influence as far as possible. And in order
Correct.
To do that, you've got to weaken the European Union, because the European Union is really, I believe, a domestic political threat for Russia. And it's certainly a threat to their imperial designs in the former Soviet space. They're trying to move towards what Kremlin strategists like to call the Europe of Nations.
That's exactly right.
You know, they want to go back to 1815 in an age of empires, because the idea of a nationalist international is a contradiction in terms. And if you can imagine a dystopian world where all these parties came to power, they'd be in conflict with each other very, very quickly.
Exactly. And then the Kremlin obviously clearly would prefer to have bilateral negotiations versus having to negotiate and talk diplomacy with the European bloc, because then they can play things a bit more and potentially get better deals. So they can just talk one-on-one to, let's say, Prime Minister Renzi. They probably would not have sanctions,
Right.
So that's kind of the view that the Kremlin takes. I think you're absolutely right about that, Brian.
No, I keep thinking back to the Holy Alliance. I keep thinking that period is something I want to do a lot of more reading on historically, because this is, I think, the world that Russia wants to move back to. Your thoughts on this, Anton? How much of a meeting of the minds are we seeing here, or how much of it is just opportunism?
It depends on every particular organization in the West that is engaged in those kind of relations. I think it is important to stress that not all the far-right parties in the West are pro-Russian. If we look at the parties in Scandinavia, they will not be pro-Russian.
Or Poland.
The major far-right or radical right-wing populist parties, they will not be pro-Russian. We can look at how they vote in the European Parliament on Russia-related resolutions, and we'll see that they are very much critical. And reading the debates associated with those resolutions, we will see so much criticism actually against Putin's regime. And then many parties, major far-right parties in Eastern Europe or Northern Europe, or in the Baltic states, you know, it's very hard to imagine them being pro-Russian. So, but this said, I think that for those organizations and parties that are ideologically inclined to support Putin's system, it is very important for them, because we need to understand most of the parties that are most of the far right parties that now are making headlines, they were formed already in the 1970s, 1980s. You know, National Front in France is a very old party, and they remained in the fringes of the socio-political life for so long, and they were ridiculed by their domestic audiences, who said, well, you are marginals, you know, you're nobody, you're anti-establishment, you cannot beat establishment, you cannot beat establishment with your funny ideas or weird ideas, with your racism and xenophobia. So Russia is very important for them, because they can say, look, Russia is a great country, it's a global power, and Russia is guided by the same ideas that we have, so we are not on the fringes, we are not marginal forces. It's just establishment in Europe cannot understand that times are changing and Russia is guided by the same ideology that we have. So we can also be governing a country. It's not even a role model, it's a very important, you know, like a moral reference for them to try to convince the public, you know, the audience, the society, their own society, they're not on the fringes anymore.
No, I think go ahead, finish your point, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it just, you know, they try to show that they can be as great as the Russians, because they believe that Russia is great.
Especially
now with Trump, why they're supporting Trump. They now can refer to look, Trump is supporting our own ideology. We can be the same. We can repeat this success with the same ideas.
Yeah, it's Peter Pomerantsev put it really aptly when he said that Putin has turned himself into the Che Guevara of the xenophobic right. I think it's almost like this sign of rebellion. Also, there was an very interesting piece. I don't know if either of you saw it this week by Fiona Hill at Brookings. We're basically saying, basically, when Putin looks at the West now, he thinks he sees kind of Russia in the 90s. You know, basically the humiliated who are left behind by globalization. And he's using this same kind of appeals to this that he used in Russia to turn resentment into power. He's trying to expand this power internationally by doing the same thing via these anti-establishment forces in the West. I want to go back also before we shift to the second half. One other thing I wanted to touch on is this idea of active measures. And Alina, you correctly point out these things have been around forever. We kind of forgot about them after the Cold War. But it makes me wonder, is this a blip or is this a long-term trend? Because if you go back to the Cold War, yeah, Russia was doing all these active measures and spending a lot of money on it. And they got exactly nothing out of it, yeah. Right? Because the Soviet Union lost the Cold War, right? And you have to wonder, is history going to repeat itself? Is this just a blip and the West will recover? Or is this a paradigm shift? Do you have any sense of that? I know it's kind of a broad, unanswerable question, but anyway, that's what I do, ask broad, unanswerable questions.
No, it's a really important question. And I've actually had quite a few conversations since our own elections here in the U.S. specifically about that. It also goes back to, I think, one of the quotes you read from Anne Applebaum earlier in the show about, you know, 2017 we're being, you know, one election away from the end of the liberal Western order, right? I do think there's a profound difference than what we saw during the Cold War versus what we're seeing now, which is why I really don't like the term the new Cold War, because what the Soviet Union was doing during the Cold War years was supporting parties that had no or very little actual grassroots support. Which is very different than what we're seeing now. As I mentioned earlier, these political parties, the populist right, and also the populist left in some countries, are being driven by domestic issues, right? Mm-hmm. So they're going forward. Your average voter of Jobbik or the National Front isn't voting for those parties because they're pro-Kremlin. That actually probably doesn't enter people's minds. Because elections are rarely made, if ever made, in foreign policy questions. They're voting for those parties because they think that they'll help them out economically, socially, culturally, whatever their motivations may be, or they just think it's time for a change, right? So that is an important difference. And because Putin has been able to build these alliances with some of these groups that are on the rise, I don't think this is a flash in the pan. You know, when we saw the emergence of what you could call the new right, the post-fascist new right in Europe with parties like the National Front that reformed itself and the Austrian Freedom Party and then others in the early 1990s, you know, that was kind of the view, I think, among many experts, that these were, you know, flash in the pan parties that are going to fade away as soon as whatever issue they were making noise about wasn't going to be an issue anymore that voters cared about. But clearly, that was a mistaken point of view. So what we're seeing now is these hugely massive, I think, political shifts. And one thing that we haven't talked about is, of course, how the rise of far-right political parties is also shifting the political space in Europe more broadly. We see center-right parties, many of them, rather than moving away or trying to exclude these far-right parties from politics, not entering into coalition governments, places like Denmark, of course, Netherlands. Again, these are not all pro-Russian parties, but they could be turned at one point. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing kind of a broader political shift to the right, towards a certain idea of what the right is, which is about national sovereignty, you know, isolationism, economic protectionism, all of these things that inherently will benefit the Kremlin's intentions and geopolitical aims in Europe. So I think we are in a profound paradigm shift. And if I could put one idea forward for you, Brian, and also for Anton, before I move away from this topic, is, you know, let's just sit back for a moment and imagine the world where you have this triangle of strange bedfellows between the populace in Europe, the Kremlin and Putin, and then, of course, Donald Trump, who's one of his senior counselors, has already been trying to reach out to some of these populist far-right movements, not just political parties, but really the movements in Europe. So what does that kind of international order look like? Is this something we can really imagine right now? I think we're going to have to.
I'm having a very hard time imagining it. One other thing I'd want to add to what you say, Alina, is that being tied to Moscow doesn't seem to harm anybody electorally. Right. We've known about these ties. They've been made public. They've been written about in the media. The bank loan to Marine Le Pen has been written about endlessly. And yet it doesn't seem, the public just doesn't seem to care about it. If you bring something like this up, you're called a McCarthyite or a retro Cold Warrior or something. Where during the Cold War, and this is one way it's very different and why we may be in a paradigm shift, that was the kiss of death. If you were seen as being tied to Moscow, yep, as a politician. Today, it's not. It doesn't seem to hurt anybody at all. Anton, last word to you before we shift to the second half.
Yeah, I'll just add something that you said, probably just to repeat myself, that the consensus that was there about that racists are unelectable or Russian funding, it's a kiss of death. It no longer works. We just need to forget about this. We need to come up with a set of very different ideas about the development or saving Western liberal democracy. So we just, you know, it's all finished. Mm. I mean, those consensus that we have. So there should be something else.
Oh, that's an optimistic thought on a Friday afternoon where we really are in a brave new world. Well, in a few moments, we will continue our discussion and look at the places where the anti-establishment wave is likely to strike next. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype Live from Washington, D.C. is Alina Polyakova, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, director of the Dino Protezio Eurasia Center, and author of the book The Dark Side of European Integration. And also joining us via Skype from Vienna is Anton Shekhovtsov, a visiting fellow at the Institute for Human Sciences and author of the forthcoming book Russia and the Western Far Right, which should be out next spring, and we're all looking forward to it. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast in iTunes, you could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Голландская парламентская партия «Свободы», вдохновившись
партии, победой... Особенно те, кого в ближайшем будущем
Марин
ждут выборы.
Обещала, что если она победит на президентских выборах...
И он 2017... из маргинальной ультраправой партии превратился в реальную
политическую силу. Правая популистская и антииммигрантская партия.
First we take Amsterdam, then we take Paris, and then we take Berlin. The Netherlands are scheduled to hold parliamentary elections in March. France will hold two rounds of its presidential election in April and May, respectively. And the big enchilada, Germany will hold elections to the Bundestag between August and October. In all of these cases, anti-establishment forces are resurgent. In the Netherlands, the anti-immigrant and anti-EU Freedom Party, led by Putin fan Geert Wilders, is leading the pack. In France, Marine Le Pen is almost certain to advance to the second round. And while the situation in Germany isn't quite that dire yet, Chancellor Angela Merkel doesn't look as invulnerable as she did not long ago, and the anti-immigrant AfD is gaining in the polls. So, Alina, to go back to the question we keep bouncing back to, we truly do feel, going into this year, that we're just few elections away from the West as from the end of the West as we know it. And in your report, you basically zeroed in on two of these three countries, France and Germany. What came out of the report specifically in those countries that gives you cause for either alarm or comfort?
Well, to start with France, I have to give full credit to one of my co-authors, Marlene Laurel, who is a professor at GW, has been studying this for a very long time, and she's really the expert on France, and we worked very closely to on this case study together. But that being said, you know, the main thing that she points to, I think, in the case study on France, is that we have, compared to Germany and the UK, which are the other two countries, a lot to be worried about in France, particularly because this pro-Russian sentiment has certainly very clearly seeped right into the mainstream of French politics. So even if you have, let's say, talking about the election, François Fillon or Sarkozy potentially being the candidate for the Republicans, during the Republican convention in France, they will both take a very pro-Russian policy. And I think one word of warning that Marlène also points to in that case study is that if that is the case, and then Le Pen ends up being the other candidate in the second round, no matter who you get, they're going to be a pro-Kremlin leaders.
No, everybody's rooting for Juppé right now that wants a different outcome.
Exactly, exactly. And what does that mean in terms of policy and relations going forward? Well, I think one very clear consequence of something like that is if we have a pro-Russian president in France, then sanctions, for example, are probably going to go down.
Yeah, yeah.
Because as soon as France wavers from the consensus with Germany, that's a done deal. Now, in Germany, I think the situation is actually much better, despite the fact that the term Putin-Versteher is a German term, and that's something that my colleague Stefan Meister from the Die GAP, who authored that case study, talks about. Germany has had this special relationship with Russia for many, many decades. And they have really, like the SPD specifically, the Social Democrats, have really prided themselves in their ability to work with the Soviet Union and this idea of realpolitik, et cetera. But at the same time, it's been interesting to observe, one, these countervailing forces in Germany today. One, of course, is the surprise rise of the AfD in local elections, and they're likely to probably get about 15%. They're polling around 15% right now in Germany in the national parliamentary elections. I don't think they pose a real challenge to Merkel, and I don't think they'll be a coalition member if Merkel stays in power and the CDU stays in power. We're likely probably going to see another grand coalition mm-hmm. between the center-left and the center-right. An interesting thing that happened in Germany after our own elections in the United States is that Merkel's approval ratings actually went up significantly.
So
Germany has really remained one of the most pro-EU countries because Germany has tied its own future to the future of the EU in a profound way. And I think this is anecdotal evidence, right? From when I talk to my friends in Germany, and maybe Anton, you do as well, the sentiment there after our elections in the U.S. has been, we can't let this happen here. Mm-hmm. We have a history here. We understand what this could potentially lead to. So I hope that with this kind of public support, if it doesn't wane, if Merkel continues to stay in power, we'll actually see Germany take more of a leadership role, to be kind of this beacon of liberal democracy in a real way. So I think actually Germany is not as badly off, despite all these very deep economic and political connections that it has with Russia, as France, for example.
So Germany's the new America, in other words. The New York Times had a very interesting piece on this.
Everybody agrees with that.
the New York Times had an interesting piece on this. We're saying that Merkel's Germany is essentially the last best hope for the Western world. Anton, before we see these two elections in France and in Germany, though, we're going to see one pretty soon in March in the Netherlands. What do you see going on there? I mean, I know the Freedom Party looks to be the leading party, but I understand they're going to have a hard time finding coalition partners. Have you taken a look at that at all?
Yeah, well, I'm not an expert, particularly expert on the Netherlands, but indeed, the Freedom Party of Geert Wilders will find it very hard to find other parties to cooperate with. So they may win the elections, but still there will be much more likely that there will be a minority coalition governing the country after the elections. But Geert Wilders he's a very interesting figure, and I would say he's even unique among the other far right activists and leaders. Because his understanding, his anti-immigration sentiments, he claims that they are coming actually from a position that liberal democracy should be defended. Mm. His understanding of Islam is that this is anti-liberal, anti-democratic religion, and they need to defend the Netherlands and liberal democracy in the Netherlands against Islam.
By aligning with an anti-democratic and anti-liberal Putin.
Yeah, so this is one of the reasons why Freedom Party is considered a far-right party. You know? But It's very important to have this in mind when we discuss Wilders and his success. So essentially, I was told by a good friend of mine and a Dutch friend of mine who said that one of the most representable or the core electorate of Geert Wilders in the Netherlands is a middle-aged, middle-class gay man. Who are really afraid that the Islamists will come and ban gay relations and lesbian relations.
God, that is irony upon irony upon irony. Good.
But we need to keep this in mind. You know how people perceive they are not voting for the Freedom Party because they consider it a racist party. They vote for them as a sort of discontent liberal Democrats who don't have any other option. To say that liberal democracy should be aggressive.
Uh-huh. Anton, would you add anything to Alina's comments regarding Germany and France?
Probably not on this, but do you want me to talk about Austria?
Yeah, actually, that's not a bad idea. Yeah. Because the presidential election's coming up.
Again, the 4th of December, there will be second rerun of the presidential election. There are two candidates, the far-right candidate Norbert Hofer from the Freedom Party of Austria, and another candidate, Alexander van der Bellen, who is supported by the Greens. So he's non-partisan, but he's supported by the Greens. It is the first time in the entire history of post-war Austria that no representative of the major parties that have been the Social Democrats and the Conservatives, they couldn't manage to get into the second round of the presidential election for the very first time in post-war history. This is a crucial moment again. But what does it tell us? Does it tell us that the far right on the rise in Austria? Yes, partially. But it also tells us that people in Austria, they want change. They voted for new forces, the Greens and the far right. These are still considered, representatives of new politics. So they voted for them, and those representatives are now competing for the presidential post. So again, this is important to understand. There is a demand for new politics. Mm-hmm. There is a demand for politicians outside this very close mainstream exchange of power between the Conservatives and the Social Democrats. Mm. People are getting tired of this.
Yeah.
And they not necessarily they think that the far right is an option. The Greens, the success of the Green candidate here is also tells us something that, it's not necessarily the far right.
And the Green candidate won the first time around, but this is a replay of the election, essentially, because there were some irregularities.
Yeah, there was some technical issue. There was some technical issue with the envelopes, with the voting by post. So they now have this rerun in December. But also what is important is also on the 4th of December, there will be a referendum in Italy.
Yes.
And... again, this because Renzi, Prime Minister Matteo Renzi, he came up with this idea of the change of the constitution, and he's now betting essentially his premiership on this referendum.
He said today he'd resign if he loses the referendum, right?
Yeah. And he's challenged by a right-wing populist movement, Five Star Movement, which is it is ridiculous in its politics, but they represent this, this rebellion against the elites, against the establishment. Mm-hmm. And again, if Renzi falls, we don't know what's going to happen next. Right. If they call for early parliamentary elections, that will add to this
all of our anxiety
number of crucial elections in 2017.
We're bumping up against time now, but I did want to return to Alina for one other thing, the place where this wave kind of began, Brexit. Your report also touched on the UK, where we don't really have a risk of any kind of pro-Kremlin force or xenophobic force coming to power, but yet we had Brexit. What did you learn about UK?
Well, I think if you look at the UK specifically, you know, it comes off pretty positively, at least compared to the other two in this report that my colleague Neil Barnett worked on, that case study. You know, I think the UK is a bit of an outlier. I mean, it is certainly exceptional when it comes to its relationship to the EU, and that's not just because of Brexit. There's been historically sort of a tense relationship between the UK and the EU. But I think what's interesting is now seeing what's going to happen with UKIP. Of course, UKIP with Nigel Farage has been the force of pro-Russian sentiment in the UK. There have been some other very small parties, but nothing like this previously. And I think what we've heard now that will happen in the UK is that UKIP is essentially kind of looking for a new agenda. And of course, Nigel Farage is trying to now position himself as this so-called bridge between President-elect Trump and the UK government, which I think is quite ridiculous and will not go through. But besides the point, he's clearly building that relationship with Donald Trump. He's been to some of his campaign rallies, etc. But what we've been hearing is that there's going to be a new social movement that will be formed and that will be well-funded, potentially by Arron Banks, who's also mentioned in the report as a big funder of the Brexit campaign. And what's interesting about the UK is that if we had better financial regulation and better access to information about campaign financing, mm-hmm. I think we would actually find a lot more. We know that the Brexit campaign, there was the unofficial Brexit campaign, leave.eu, received money from these offshore shell companies that nobody can trace. I actually heard from a Swedish colleague who studies this in Sweden recently that one of the firms called Rise Capital was registered actually in Stockholm or in Sweden, but then was funding the leave.eu campaign. Again, nobody really knows where this money is coming from. And again, this goes back to your question of corruption and these kleptocratic networks, right? And how are they actually contributing to political influence in Western countries? And I think the UK would not have come off so easy if we actually could look at some of these global networks of financial ties and links that go through multiple intermediaries before we actually get to some Russian-connected oligarch or perhaps even to the Kremlin and to the Russian government itself. So I think, you know, if I had to think of some policy recommendations, I know we're running out of time, but the report does list quite a few, but this is one of them that I think is very important. We do need to give financial regulators at the national level in the EU kind of more teeth to do the work that they're supposed to do to expose these kinds of relationships. Because until we get there, I mean, all of these things will just be hearsay and we'll only be able to look at these kinds of personal relationships and networks without really being able to get at the root of following the money.
No, from your mouth to God's ears. I've been harping on this myself as well for a long time. If we clean up a lot of these kleptocratic networks and give the regulators some teeth, we wouldn't be able to solve this problem, but it would be a lot more solvable. But with all this opaque money floating around, it's very, very difficult. And we are truly bumping up into the end. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Washington, D.C. has been Alina Polyakova, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, deputy director of the Dino Patricio Eurasia Center, and author of the book The Dark Side of European Integration. And also joining us via Skype from Vienna, Austria, has been Anton Chekhovtsov, a visiting fellow at the Institute for Human Sciences and author of the forthcoming book Russia and the Western Far Right, which should be out in the spring, and we are all looking forward to it. Thank you both for a great discussion.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you. I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.